passages quickly and so that we can all hear it together. Ephesians 6, 1 through 4. Barry, would you read that? And then Claudia, would you read Colossians 3, 20 and 21?
Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor thy father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, that it might be well with thee, and that thou mayest live long on the earth. And ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord.
All right.
Children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well pleasing to the Lord. Fathers, do not exasperate your children, that they may not lose heart.
Good. All right. Yes. That's a terrific translation of that, isn't it? Do not exasperate your children, lest they lose heart. All right. The first question that we discussed was, what are the two basic attitudes that children are to demonstrate toward their parents, and what are they? Two basic attitudes.
Obedience.
What's that?
Obedience.
All right. Obedience.
Honor.
Honor. All right, what's the difference? Yes?
Honor is an attitude.
Okay. Honor is an attitude. All right. And what about obedience? All right. You could not categorically say in every case. You see, there might be some times when your parent commands you to have a certain attitude, wants you and expresses it very strongly. Honoring is an attitude, but it may follow through with actions. Like if I send my mother a birthday card, it's honoring her by remembering her on her birthday, but it followed through with an action. But by and large, I think that's a pretty good, for the most part, honoring with our attitudes and obedience by our action. Now, having identified these two, how would you explain the differences between the two and their practical application? In other words, most of you here now are, well, all of you here are married this week. We're all married. Now, to what extent are we still responsible to our parents in these two categories?
We still owe them honor, but we don't owe them the same obedience that we did as children.
All right, would everyone agree with that? Okay, Roy?
Put an age on that course.
Well,
at what point did you come out underneath that?
I would say when, at whatever point you leave your family. Definitely when you start another thing.
All right, George talked to you about leaving and cleaving. Leaving and cleaving to your wife. One practical point is that I've lived 40 years now, and I can't remember ever hearing a parent give a command to a person who was married and away from home or something like that. There comes a point in time in which most parents, now there are exceptions to this, and sometimes it's very difficult for parents to break the emotional umbilical cord and to let the child have his life. But from just one practical standpoint, I rarely ever see a parent. You see, there's a difference between expressing an opinion and expressing a command. See, obedience, as I understand it, is a response to a command. You command and I obey. Now, How many of you have been to the Institute of Basic Youth Conflicts? Okay, a little salting of that. You remember Bill Gothard says he makes a difference between the chain of command and the chain of counsel. And I'd say that for practical working purposes, that's a good definition. But see, the facts are that throughout my life, I am responsible to honor my parents. And it's interesting the promise that goes with that. Honor thy father and mother, that what? That what?
Thy days may be long.
All right, that thy days may be long. And there's another. What is it?
That it may be well.
Now, what does that mean?
No sickness.
You'll always be in good financial condition.
In other words, it's a solve-all of all problems, huh? Well, I'd say that that's probably clear conscience. You see, I'm not completely, totally endorsing, and I don't mean to do that, the Institute, but I think one thing that Bill Gothard has crystallized and clarified that I've seen it in Africa, I've seen it with missionary children in Africa, I've seen it with African children themselves, that you see, the first opportunity that God gave children to learn how to respond to authority was when they were children growing up in their being under their parents. And you see, if we can't learn to respond with obedience and honor to this, we go out into life and we never learn to respond to authority anywhere else. And whenever you find, if you find in your own heart, if you're in the military or you're on a college campus or somewhere, and it really grates on you to have somebody tell you what to do, see, the chances are it may be that there's an unresolved conflict back here that's never been solved. And I've watched it in a few cases, and it seems to be that, or in several cases, and it seems to be that when God gave the Ten Commandments, one that He put in there was honor thy father and mother. And, yes?
Well, I don't know. I guess it's like a hard time with this, but it says honor and obey your parents. And I really can't see why there's a big conflict between honoring and obeying and leaving your parents and cleaving to your wife. And personally, I think Cheryl and I, we should honor and obey our parents even though we are married, because we have left them and we have cleaved together. And I don't really see the two conflicting. Let me cite one example.
Sure.
That really impressed us a whole lot. These two people married on staff for Crusade at Baton Rouge, LSU, and they were married, I believe, 5 years, and for 5 years they tried to have a child, and they couldn't, and so they went to an adoption agency and got, like, plans for their house, you know, to fix up, and had the child, everything was, you know, almost completed. They told their parents, and her parents were delighted, and his mother was delighted, but his father's there. No way, no adoption. He said, Dad, I honor you. And his father is not a Christian, was not a Christian at the time. And he said, Father, I honor you and I obey you. I mean, even though, we don't believe the same way, but I still honor you and I still will obey you. He said, let us think about this. So he and his wife, they really prayed about it and really talked it over. And they decided that they should honor and respect and obey his parents. So they went back and said, Dad, he said, I'm going to have to take your word. It's God's word, speaking through you, because I'm having to honor and obey you. And he said, no, I do not want you to adopt a child. because they're just torn up about it, just completely torn up. And 2 months later, she was pregnant. And as a result of that, he became a Christian. And I believe that if you honor and obey your parents, even though you've left them to cleave to your wife, I believe God will honor.
That's excellent. See, and the point I made a while ago, though, is I have rarely ever heard a parent say to a married child, just really come down on something, do not do that. Well, one thing, you can never be the loser, because you see, respect for authority and obedience is basically a trust in God. It's saying that God can work in the king's heart as the rivers of water. He can turn it whithersoever he will. And so therefore, I'll just trust God to either change his heart or work around him. And you see, that basic spirit of humility and meekness is unbeatable. And I think that if a father came across like that, of course, the only situation where you would ever not do that is when a parent asks you to do something that God has asked you to do. In black and white, it's in the Word. But you see, God greatly, greatly honored. And I appreciate that. Thanks for sharing that illustration. Well, I know that George is going into this further in the second hour, but let's go on down through so that we cover the full scope of the questions. Any other question on that before we go on to the idea of training children on obedience? Yes.
Well, we put one of the differences between obedience and honor is that obedience can be forced by the parents and on the children, but that honor is something that they earn as the children see their life start. You know, children learn to honor.
All right. Now let me ask you this, though. Let's say that the father is a drunkard and the mother is a prostitute. Now, which is hardly worthy of honor. But is a child still responsible to honor his parents when they live like that?
Absolutely.
All right, how can you honor them when they live like that? For instance, I was talking with a young fellow one day, and he had some very deep problems in his life. And I just began to ask him about his early relationships. He talked about how his father died when he was 2 years old and how his mother became just a high-class prostitute, bringing her boyfriends home and embarrassed him terribly with his friends. And he just, this inner feeling of embarrassment had been all through the years in his heart. Now, what about a situation like that where the parent is very irresponsible in their behavior? In what way can we show honor? Yeah. All right, good, excellent. Claudia?
We're not responsible for their actions, but for our reactions to what they do.
Did you hear that? See, both of those comments were very key. See, you don't necessarily endorse their actions, but you respect their position, that God has put them there. And we're not responsible for their actions, but for our reaction to them. And by the way, when we learn to react to them in a Christ-like way, you see, what is happening is we are developing what? Self-control. See, one of the things that a child early learns to do is if he doesn't like something, he hits at it. I don't like it. Kick. See, well, we're going to get into this, but it's interesting that many times adults are just have carried over that same lack of self-control in life. Many of us find, aren't there times when you just kind of, you know? Well, if that goes to extremes, see, what it means is that I have some distance to go yet in developing self-control. It also develops a faith in God to be able to work around that. So, we have this morning honor and obedience. Now, in Deuteronomy 6, 6 and 7 in Proverbs 27:23, we have some suggestions as to excellent principles of teaching and relationships in the home. What are they and how can they be applied? Now, what are some of the principles of teaching and relationships in the home that you found in those two verses? All right, the devotion of the parent. In other words, how would you state that, Dee?
I would just say that, you know, the Lord God in our lives before we get married.
Okay. The word in the parent's heart. And you remember we talked about yesterday the fact that it's not just memorized being in the heart, but it's the process of meditation that weaves it into the fiber of our life. And when David says, "Thy word have I hid in my heart that I might not sin against thee," he didn't mean just memorizing, but meditating on it so that it became the philosophy of our lifestyle. Yeah, Larry?
I'd like to have you change that word "in" to "on." Make that word should be the burden of the parent's heart.
All right.
I think that's a little more accurate translation.
All right, we'll put that in there. Word on the parent's heart.
You know, the word of God should be the real burden of my heart. It's a matter of the heart, and it grips my emotions. And like, you know, I'm back at the burden of the word of the Lord, just almost more than I can handle.
All right, excellent. Yeah.
Just one example that I thought of when he told about his example of obedience to the parents. Is I was just thinking, you know, what more perfect way to teach it to your children than to show it to your own parents and then observe it.
That's right. And by the way, this is what happens when the scripture, I think, says that he visits the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the grandchildren to the third and fourth generations. You see, if I act irresponsibly, let's say that there's some irresponsible behavior here on the part of this parent, the child sees this and he may not like it, but because of the emotional focus on it, he's constantly thinking, "I don't like that. He shouldn't do that to me. He shouldn't do that to me." But he turns around, and because it has become his thought pattern, he turns around and he does it himself. Let's say temper, lack of self-control. And so this child starts doing it. And then they pass it on down, and this child starts doing it until somebody somewhere in the chain says, "Hey, wait a minute," and blows the whistle and says, "This is not Christ-like." And so we begin, we cut that, we change our thought pattern, we stop reacting that way by the power of God, and then all of a sudden we've started a new chain reaction with righteousness going to the second and third generation. You see, when the children... when this child that's born in this home someday is 12, 13, 14, and he hears his father stand up and give that testimony in a service, he will not only see that example, but there will be others where he's seen the parent trust God's sovereignty and to not fight against the powers that be. And the child will find the emotional resources with which to react that way. I had a friend in the Navigators tell me the other day that as he's driving along the road, or just in life, he'll oftentimes, if something frustrating comes, he'll say, "Rotten joker." You know, he was driving along one day in his car, and his little three-year-old daughter was in the back seat, and a car pulled right in front of him and cut right in front of him, and this little girl said, "Rotten joker." And he said, all of a sudden, he realized, right on living stereo, I mean, living, yeah... that his daughter was picking up exactly what he did, you see. So we do reproduce our weaknesses and our strengths. All right, so the principle here is that the word is to be on the parent's heart, living it. And then what do? Okay?
You teach it to your children, and also at all times. It's not when I speak and teach, I mean, it's not just when you're talking to them. But every moment of your life, because the child's aware of you even when you're not conscious of what you're doing.
Yeah, that's right. All right, what are the times it mentions when you sit down, when you rise up, when you lie down, when you walk by the way? So in every situation of life, there's an opportunity. Now, George mentioned the other day that we don't want to become overly spiritual so that we're constantly sermonizing to the children. But what can be the difference? What is the difference between sermonizing and turning the kids off and actually taking every circumstance of life and relating it to the Lord and His truth? What is the difference as to whether the child is going to respond positively to it? Yes?
Well, what would you say if you said that the Christian walk should permeate every situation from home? Being there doesn't have to be spoken all the time, but just your life.
Yes, that's right. All right, in other words, the example of the father and mother's life, it permeates and it becomes a style of life, an atmosphere in which to trust the Lord. Yeah, Larry?
Maybe the difference is, the Bible says in all your ways, acknowledge the Lord. It doesn't say in all your ways, preach about Him. You know, when I get a free 20 minutes on the parking meter, I just say out loud, well, thank you, Lord. My little boy notices that. I don't say, now, just sit down over here. We're going to tell you all about how the Lord gives you free parking.
Yeah, beautiful. Yeah, okay.
I think it's kind of how how a child responds to the parent, how the parent responds back is in direct relationship how the parent responds to God and back. And the child can see that, and he just responds correctly when he sees the same relationship.
Do you remember yesterday we talked about the fact that this matter of playing together? It seems to me that the two things that I have picked up in counseling and in my own life as I look back on my relationship to my parents, the two main things that causes a child to be open is the fact that you're fun to live with, and secondly, you live what you preach. You're not holding a double standard, one for what you're telling the child he ought to do. You see, if I tell a child, if I go over and I bop him for losing his temper, but as I do it, I come over and I lose my temper in bopping him for losing his temper, you see, the kid, he can put two and two together. See, and unconsciously, he may not realize that, but what he's saying in his heart, he does not have the emotional reinforcement with which to accept that lesson. So what we've done is really angered him and exasperated him. And on this matter of children being willing to receive lessons, it seems to me that that the two key ingredients in it is that you have a living example of what you preach in your own life, and secondly, that you're not stodgy, that you're really fun to live with. I remember picking up a magazine of Faith at Work one day and reading an article by Bruce Larson, who at that time, I guess, was the director of Faith at Work and still is. He wrote an article entitled, Are You Fun to Live With? And boy, sometimes we Christians can become really stodgy at home. There are children who've told me, I can never remember ever hearing my parents laugh. Well, 6 years ago when I went to Kenya, Leroy Iams came up to me and he said, you know, Jim, he said, I'm praying one thing for you as you go to Africa, and that is that God will give you a sense of humor. He says, not that everything that, you know, that everything won't be funny, but he says that there'll be times when there are real stresses, and he says, you'll need to learn to just laugh at yourself until you can figure out what to do about it. And, you know, God really answered that prayer. There's something about a sense of humor and of being able to laugh at yourself and to unwind and to be fun to live with. Not laughing at people or laughing at somebody else. Laugh at yourself. But, you know, there's some very humorous things in the Gospels where it's evident that Jesus had a sense of humor. So maybe that'll help us But taking every opportunity to teach principles of Scripture. And the wonderful thing about it is that often these things begin to come back to us in lessons. See, throughout the lives of our three children, we've constantly talked to them. If you ever have a problem, just take it to Jesus. Tell Jesus about it. Well, one day in Nairobi, I was driving down the street, and my boy, who at that time was about 6 or 7, he was in the back seat, and it was one of those days when I kind of wanted to let off steam, and I said, "Rodney, I just don't know how I'm going to get everything done today. I have got so many things on my do list that I'm just frustrated. I don't know what to do." So I thought I'd be transparent with him, and he just leaned up, got off the back seat, and came up and whispered in my ear, and he said, "Daddy, if you'll ask Jesus, he'll help you." And I turned around and I just gave him a little smile. I said, "Thanks, son, I needed that." And that's true. You see, it's not just all one way, but sometimes the kids have an opportunity to give something back to you. Okay, what's the principle in Proverbs 27:23?
No.
Yeah.
You know your family and what's happening around.
All right. Awareness. You know, there's one TV station. I think it was back in New York City that a number of years ago, about 10:30 at night, there flashed on the television screen, "Mother and Dad, do you know where your child is tonight?" And just every night at 10:30 that came on. See, well, what the tragedy is that most parents are really just not aware. They cannot read signals. They don't know what's going on in that child's life. Johnny goes to Sunday school. Johnny sits in church. Johnny sings the hymns. He sits there while I read the Bible story. But do we as parents really know what's going on down inside? And sometimes it's because we're too busy. One Navigator staff member who 20 years ago when I first met him here at the Glen had a terrible stutter. He could hardly say a sentence without stuttering. Today he has a wonderful, godly Christian wife, speaks very clearly and plainly, has a dynamic ministry. But he told about how as a young boy growing up, his father was the head of the school board of one of the largest cities in America. And his mother was an alcoholic, and every night they were out at parties, and his dad would just give him $5, $10, $15 to go to a movie, go to a restaurant. Every night he was out eating by himself. And in this time of loneliness and emotional vacuum, he began to develop this emotional problem in his life. You see, what his heart really yearned for was somebody who cared. I saw a cartoon of Snoopy one day walking down the street, and he was saying, "Nobody cares for me. Nobody, you know, wants to know what's happening inside me." And all of a sudden it started raining, and he just was oblivious to it. And some stranger just opened the door as Snoopy walked by, and the stranger said, "Hey, you dumb, stupid dog, why don't you get in out of the rain?" And the last picture showed Snoopy sighing, saying, "Somebody cares." You see, when it says, "Look well to thy flock, know the state of thy flock," there's an awareness. We care what's going on down inside. Yeah.
There's something else that goes along with that. It's the other extreme. The children know where you are.
That the children know where you are.
We came from a situation in Seattle, an apartment complex, that either due to the just lack of concern of the parents or just their job situation, kids were left alone, you know, 20 hours out of the 24 hours a day.
Yeah. And see, that was one of the problems in the life of Lee Harvey Oswald. He'd come home in the afternoon. His mother worked constantly. And in the report that came out after the assassination, he'd come home just to himself every afternoon. Had no idea where his mom was. She didn't know where he was, nor cared. So the principle there is that we take the responsibility to find out how things really are inside. I had a man come up to me one day here on the Glen. He said, "Jim, how are you?" And I said, "Fine." And then my eyes met his eyes, and he was just staring right through me, and he says, "No, I mean down inside, how are things really?" Well, you know, I sensed by the way he said it that he really cared. He didn't want just my little cliche answer. He wanted to know, how are things? Well, it challenges us as parents to really to be aware of knowing how things really are. Now, in your opinion, what should be the primary objectives in training and disciplining our children? What is it that we're basically trying to get at in discipline and training? Let's just listen. Yeah.
Transferring their dependence upon you as a parent to their dependence upon God.
All right. Dependence upon God is what we eventually want to see. And there are steps to that, though, aren't there? But that's our final goal, our primary goal, to get them to depend upon God. What else?
Teaching the ways of God.
All right. Dependence upon God, obedience to the ways of God. Okay, what else? And by the way, probably under this would be just the idea of responsible behavior. See, we want to teach the child how to behave responsibly. Okay, what else?
And everything to know, give an attitude of love them no matter what, except
I'm going to put there. Feeling of acceptance, there is a security. In my acceptance. And by the way, if they don't learn that from us, it may be very hard for them to feel accepted by God. Okay, what else?
To learn to have a personal relationship.
All right, a dependence on God. Let's put that here, also a personal faith. What else? Yeah, David?
Bring them to maturity in every aspect. Probably a primary one would be spiritual.
All right, maturity.
Jim, I don't want to raise a good boy. I want to raise a man.
All right.
I agree with what they've said here.
Okay, you see, these are tied very closely together. Spiritually, emotionally, and socially. You see, and part of this, emotional, is that there is a self-control that's developed. See, to me, this is one of the key things, is a development of self-control in the child. Anything else? Yeah, Claudia?
Well, the Bible constantly says something about fearing the Lord, and it doesn't mean to be afraid of the Lord, but it's sort of to hold him in awe. I'm wondering if maybe we should teach our children to have somewhat of a fear. I don't mean to be afraid of this.
But a reverence?
Yeah.
Yeah, see,
so
maybe...
So that they can transfer that to a fear of the Lord. Like if you're thinking you have murder to parents, you might transfer that to you with murder of God.
Okay, let me tie it in like this. You see, one of the things we want to teach is respect for authority. But this, eventually, is to lead to a deep reverence of God. See, and just teaching a child about God is not the total picture. But as they learn to respect us, they learn to have a healthy respect and fear for God. All right? Yeah.
Well, I would think one of the objectives in discipline in particular, something I heard was that a child harbors guilt when they do something wrong and they don't have a way of getting rid of that guilt when they're small and they need to get rid of it. And if you don't discipline them, they have no way of getting rid of it and builds in their life.
Isn't that terrific? So, could I put down here a clear conscience? And the way they get that is by discipline and by a feeling of security in your acceptance. In other words, you don't bring those things up.
Turn it up a little bit. You can't quite see it.
Whoops, okay.
Just loosen that screw on the left there and tilt it. There you go.
Thank you, George.
You bet.
Clear conscience. Yeah. Cheryl?
I think love should go at the top of the six, because you can honestly have all those if that happens with the love. Or if that's just clean.
No?
Like in Corinthians, you know, it says you can have all these without loving.
All right. Would that come under this matter of maturity? Or is it a separate thing? Could we put that down under that? It's separate. All right, let's just put it up here at the top. We want the child how to love God, to love us, to love others. To be outgoing rather than self-centered. Which is others-centered, you know. Someone has said joy is Jesus, others, and you. In that order. That's the secret of joy. Well, we want to teach a child to do that. All right, well, our time's up. Sorry. Really appreciate your good ideas, but George needs 10 minutes at the end of this session. And then we'll get together for the message afterwards. George, I've introduced Ken to them already.
Good, I'm glad. I was talking with Ken back there. Glad to have him here. And good morning. How y'all doing? Terrific. Yeah. How did this go? I'm sorry I wasn't here. I had to be in a meeting, and I would like to have heard your reactions to many of these things. You know, I think it's a tremendous thing. How many of you now, let's do it again. How many of you do not have children at the present time? All right. That's exactly how I remembered our statistics from the earlier poll we took. Now, really, this is a fantastic opportunity for you to begin to get some basic guidelines and begin thinking in terms of what you want to establish as a basis for the development of your family as the Lord gives you direction. It's a tremendous privilege. I don't mean that you're here listening to us, but that you're anywhere being exposed to some of these guidelines. Just yesterday I was involved in a situation where I'm sure the mother would have given anything to have had this kind of instruction and this kind of guideline giving about 4 years ago. And they're facing some tremendous stress and tension now in their relationship with the children because of some unintended but unfortunate miscalculations on their part. And it's going to be, you know, it's going to be remedied. It isn't something that can't be remedied, but it's not going to be easy. Because some of these patterns, once they get started, it's difficult to change them, and it takes a great deal of personal discipline and willingness to face the issues and confront them and work your way through them. Well, what I want to do this morning is take just these few moments to ask you to listen to something that I've been requested to do, and I'm delighted to do it because so many of you have been asking questions about the Navigators. How many of you, just by way of personal interest, how many of you knew very little about the Navigators before you came here to this conference? May I see your hands? All right. And then some of the rest of you may know more about the Navigators, but not what really is taking place in our development. Last night we showed you the film strip, and you had an opportunity to observe what the basic concepts are that the Navigators are seeking to perpetuate. Primarily the fact that residing in every individual is the potential of spiritual reproduction. I would say that that is one of the primary concepts that we are seeking to incorporate and to perpetuate as we minister to people. That everyone, every individual has the potential of spiritual reproduction and can multiply themselves in the life of another individual who can do the same thing in someone else's life. And we're beginning to see this now on a very broad basis all over the world. Well, in connection with this, there are obvious developmental stresses that take place in any group, in any organization. Some of you are familiar with the fact that at our conferences every summer, we have various offering projects of one kind and another. And you've noticed the little display up here, some of you have stopped and looked at it more carefully, and so you know something about this decade of development in which we have been involved and are still involved in the United States. Now, some of you probably have received a visit already. Perhaps even some of you have already made some kind of a commitment or a pledge to the decade of development. And we certainly want to respect that. But there may be others who don't know about it, and so we want to inform you so that you can be thinking about it and praying about it. And then this evening, we'll give you an opportunity to see if this is something that you feel the Lord is laying on your heart in order for you to participate in. You'll have time today to discuss it as a couple, to pray together after hearing the information that I want to share with you. We have four basic goals that we're trying to accomplish in this decade of development. And I'd like to just share them with you very briefly so that you have it in mind. The first one, as we mentioned last night, is to clearly communicate to all of the people that are interested in the work of the Navigators. And there are thousands because they've attended conferences of one kind or another or used some of our Bible study materials. To communicate to these people adequately what the Navigators are doing, where we are in our current development, and what our projects are and goals for the future. So, here in North America, this is what the decade of development has had as one of its primary goals. Secondly, we want this information, as we disseminate it, to provide a broader prayer base. Now, whether the Lord lays it on your heart to communicate with us or to collaborate with us financially, I would really make a special request of you who have been at this conference this week that you accept the responsibility of praying for the Navigators from here on, just as part of your ministry. And if you desire to do that, we will be happy to send you some information consistently that will keep you up to date on some of the things that are happening in the work of the Navigators so that you might be able to pray more intelligently. One of these things, of course, would be our little publication, The Navigator Log. And if you're not receiving that and would like to receive it, we want to know that and we'll put your name on it. That's something we send out at no expense to anyone, to simply inform you that you might pray more effectively regarding the Navigator ministry. And we really would like to request that you accept that as a part of your ministry responsibility. Then third, we are trying to bring in whatever finances are necessary to meet the personal needs of our representatives, both in North America and overseas. We establish basic budgets for all of our staff people, and they are responsible to seek to raise that money in order that they might have friends supporting that ministry. Well, some of those budgets have not been what they should be, and so we are seeking in this decade of development to help meet those needs as well. And we feel that some real strides have been made in making these needs met, and with few exceptions, basically they've been accomplished. The fourth goal, now you have the three, the first one to inform, the second one to recruit prayer, the third to get our budgets of our representatives up to what they should be, and then finally, we're trying to raise about $3,900,000, almost $4 million, basically, in cash and faith promises to cover needs of capital improvements here at Glen Eyrie, plus administrative service expenses. Now, as our work has grown worldwide, the administrative services have also grown. The demands are greater. When you have 1,200 people working around the world and seeking to take care of their basic bookkeeping and some of the printing for them and their prayer letters, and on, all these administrative services require people to be able to serve them and facilities to be able to do it effectively. And so this money that we're seeking to raise in cash and promises will be used to meet some of the capital improvements necessary here at Glen Eyrie, where you are currently. Now, there are a number of buildings that need to be considered in this respect. For example, we need to build an administrative services building. I don't know if you've taken a tour of the Glen to the point where you've seen our office situation, but right now we have offices in 5 different buildings. And as a result, it does not make for the most efficient operation. The building that we are currently using for our administrative services is a building that was built to house our Glen Erie maintenance. But in the meantime, we've made it into offices because we simply had no room for the people where we had them before. And even so, we're already in need of more office space. Eventually, that building, which we are now using, will be given over to Glen Erie to use for their maintenance, where they'll have their shops and do their repair work and all the rest of it to keep this place functioning as it should. But currently, we're having to use that. So we are in desperate need of an administrative services building in which we will have our computer services and our printing and our accounting and so forth, all that goes into the administrative services. The need for this, of course, is amplified by the growth of our work, which in the last few years, it's been growing at the rate of about 25% a year, which is a very large increase of any work on an annual basis. So the demands are just fantastic. Then another need here on Glen Erie, and this will interest you, even though this week you have not faced this particular situation, every other conference, as I understand it, every other conference is going to face this need here at Glen Erie this summer, and that is a housing need. We simply do not have the housing that we need to take care of the guests that come for our staff or for our conferences. For example, in 1966, just a few years ago, our total attendance in conferences was about 350 single and married adults. This year, we'll anticipate approximately 1,000 adults. Now, of those, approximately 20% or 200 people will have to stay in motels downtown. Now, they're accommodated well, and there's no problem, except that they lose the feel, the spirit, that you've been able to enjoy of being together all week long and just getting to know one another and developing a friendship and the fellowship and the interpersonal relationships and so on. So we would like to eliminate the need for sending people off the Glen because we're overcrowded at our conferences. And what we're hoping to do is to build a building here, provide a lodge that will take care of that. I believe that lodge, I lost this particular page, but I believe it's to be a 32-room lodge, a new guest lodge that will have 32 rooms, which means we can take care of 32 couples or any number of single people, because we can double them up in bunk beds and put 4 to a room and really increase our capacity right here on the Glen. By the way, we might even have some rooms with double beds. Who knows? I said that for Russ Reed is here, and I said it for his information. So we have 2 needs that I've mentioned: the administrative services, the new lodge, and then the third one is water, city water on Glen Erie. At the present time, we are still operating on the system that General Palmer set up, and it's been functioning fairly well, but we see very, very easily that we're going to run out of adequate water supply, primarily in the area of fire defense. And so at the present time, we are in the process of negotiating, trying to find out what's involved to get city water provided for us out here. So there you have 3 of the major capital improvements that we feel need to be done in order to be good stewards of what God has given us here at Glen Erie and in trying to minister to our worldwide navigator ministry. So what we would like for you to do is take some time this afternoon. Now, you'll have some free time, and just talk to one another about it, pray about it, and see if God would have you be involved in this. Please, I hope you understand, we are not trying to take advantage of the fact that you are here to put the pressure on you. There is no pressure involved. This is simply to inform you. Some of you may not have known some of these things, and because of that, Having given you the information, perhaps now you'll have a different concept regarding how you might be involved in the work of the navigators in some way. People often ask, well, how much or how can we get involved in this? Well, obviously, we have no set figures to try and communicate to a group, because we feel it's something that each one has to determine for themselves. But you could imagine that in a group this size, $10 to $15 a month, if each couple were to say, for the next 3 years, which is what we're working in this area, a commitment of 3 years, basically, if they would say, for the next 3 years, we'd like to give $10 or $15 a month, we figure, at least those who did the figuring, that this would raise approximately $10,000 just from this one conference. Now, just to give you an idea, that's how much it would cost, about $10,000 it would cost to completely furnish one of the new guest rooms in this 32-room lodge. That's right. You know, it's amazing. You don't realize how much it costs per unit after you figure the carpeting, all of the electrician's work, the plumbing, all of the fixtures, the furniture, the drapes. It's an amazing thing, because that's a low figure if you go down and ask Holiday Inn how much they charge, or rather how much it costs them to figure one room. It's an amazingly expensive process. But just think, you know, we could have one room that this conference pledged. We'd put a little plaque up there. See, Scriptural Home Seminar 1974. Well, give it some thought. Obviously, not. What was that?
You want a double
bed? All right. Now, that's just to give you an idea. Obviously, some of you won't be able to do that. We know that. But by the same token, some may be able to do a little bit more. And we just give you that arbitrary figure to give you an idea of what might be done with regards to how you can participate. Let me read something for you in closing, just to remind you what God says about this matter of giving. It's not unfamiliar to you. You're very familiar with this passage. It's 2 Corinthians 9, beginning with verse 6. And it says this. The point is this. He who sows sparingly will also reap sparingly. And he who sows bountifully will also reap bountifully. Each one must do as he has made up his mind, not reluctantly, nor under compulsion. For God loves a cheerful giver, and God is able to provide you with every blessing in abundance, so that you may always have enough of everything and may provide in abundance for every good work. That's what God promises. And all we ask is that you pray about it and consider it. And then tonight at the meeting, we'll give an opportunity for you to make whatever expression you want in this area. Any questions regarding what I've tried to share with you this morning? Yes. We would be happy to arrange that, Lyle. The question that has been asked is, would any of you be interested in taking a tour of the grounds to see some of the offices and things I've told you about this morning? If so, Lyle, why don't I just appoint you and talk to Lyle if you're interested in that kind of a project. And then, Lyle, if you need some help, we'll work it out with you. All right, but I'll ask you to be the liaison, if you will. If you're interested, just let Lyle know. Any other questions? All right. Let's be dismissed to our coffee break and come back in. If we could get them back in here by 5 minutes after, Rock, I'd appreciate that very much. All right?